the airport. I'm used to just, you have excellent caffeinated beverages. So I'm going to be speaking about a slightly unusual Higgs decay mode that can arise in fairly, I'll say not too crazy supersymmetric models. And it leads to some interesting signatures at the Tevatron in the LHC. And one thing, I'll get some philosophy into this at some point, but one thing we found also is that this sort of highlighted, at least for me, how important it is to look very broadly in LHC data for new physics. Because it's, even though there are a lot of searches planned and we have all kinds of work done, it's really, really easy to miss stuff that could be there if you don't really go out and look for it. So I have to say, this is in collaboration with John Mason and David Poland. They're both very excellent postdocs. And, okay, so here's the big picture. You have to run off in 5 minutes. So hope you'll at least get the big picture.
The signature I'm looking at is I'm taking a Higgs it's a Higgs in a supersymmetric model, but it's a Higgs in a fairly big corner of supersymmetric models in which this Higgs behaves very much like a standard model Higgs, in that it couples to gauge bosons, basically like the standard model Higgs. It's essentially the state responsible for generating fermion masses. It couples to the fermions like a standard model Higgs. The difference, though, is that unlike a standard model Higgs, this particular supersymmetric Higgs has decays into neutralinos, these guys, which are mixtures of the superpartners of the neutral gauge bosons and the neutral Higgses. And more specifically, I'm going to consider the case where each of these neutralinos then subsequently decays into a gravitino and a photon, where the gravitino is just the superpartner of the graviton. And the upshot of this, I should also add that these decays of neutralinos into photon gravitino can occur effectively promptly on collider scales in scenarios of low scale gauge mediated supersymmetry breaking. And the signature that you get out of this, and the signature I'm going to talk about at the Tevatron and the LHC, is essentially two photons plus missing energy. The gravitinos are stable, they just shoot out of the detector, you don't see them at all. But you add up all the transversal momenta and you find something non-zero and you call it missing energy.
It's not going to be. It's going to be significant. I'll come back to how much of this you can actually have.
You said that it's in a couple of quarks, like the standard model Higgs. There's no Glashow Weinberg symmetry? You don't have two separate Higgses for up and down?
Oh, there are two separate Higgses.
Okay.
But
I just want to know what you meant by that.
I'm going to... I'll be looking at the minimal supersymmetric standard model, what's called the decoupling limit, where you have a light Higgs and you have a heavy Higgs among CP even states. And the light Higgs effectively has the couplings of a standard model Higgs. Whereas the heavy Higgs, in some sense,
it is integrated into data.
You can say that, but the really, if you look at the couplings to gauge bosons, the light state basically couples the same way as the standard model Higgs. The heavy state is largely decoupled from the gauge bosons.
Yeah, I think I know what you're doing.
Okay, so motivation. I guess I probably don't need to motivate this too much, but we really, really want to find the Higgs. If there's one thing we get out of the LHC, well, we either want to find the Higgs or show that it's not there. Let's convince ourselves of that. Of course, the Higgs is what underlies electric symmetry breaking when it gets evolved. And we've already tried really, really hard to find the Higgs. And so far, our most successful search, or most successful attempt, has been at LEP. And LEP bounds a standard model like Higgs to have a mass larger than about 114 GeV. This also assumes that the k-modes of that Higgs are standard model like. Now, we also have indirect evidence for Higgs from positional electroweak measurements. We have positional electroweak measurements at LEP and SLAC and some other places, and these are just great. These are essentially observations of various standard model observables related to the electroweak sector. And they've been measured to such a high degree of accuracy that if you just take the standard model at T level, you configure observables, you get the wrong answer. When you put in loop corrections, it turns out the loop corrections pushed you in the right direction, and you get the right answer. Or put another way, the precision is at the loop level for these observables. And one thing that goes into this loop calculation for the observables is a contribution from the Higgs. So for example, you have Higgs loops correcting the W and Z self-energies. And when people do fits to the precision electric data in the standard model, they assume that the Higgs is there. And when evaluating these loops, they put in a value of the Higgs mix. And they let it float. And what's found is that for some values of the Higgs mass, you get a good fit. For some other values, you don't get a good fit. So this is this plot is sometimes called the blue band plot. And this plot summarizes the fact that you need these Higgs loops, at least within the standard model. So the blue band corresponds roughly to a chi-squared per degree of freedom for the standard model fit to position off 2 week. As a function of the Higgs mass, you plug into these loops. The yellow regions are the regions ruled out by direct searches for the Higgs. So this region up to about 114 is ruled out by LEP. This small little region is a region ruled out now by Tevatron searches. And you can see that to get a smallish chi-square, you want to live sort of in this region, between about 114 and about 150. Okay, so the Higgs is also a bit puzzling. The potential for the Higgs, of course, induces light wave symmetry breaking. And it happens to also be sensitive to quantum corrections from heavy stuff. Okay. So suppose you have some heavy state.
Just a quick question. So the prop previously, so that's only assuming one standalone, right?
This is the standalone, yes.
If there's anything else, then this is completely gone.
Yeah, so you can put in more stuff so that you have a good fit with this other junk plus the heavier Higgs, for example.
Okay.
But it is interesting that if you just take the standard model itself, uh-huh. It does work. It does work as is, provided you have a Higgs mass in this range. So, I mean, if you want to be uncharitable, you could argue that if there is other stuff that moves the positional electric fit around, such that you also have to move the Higgs mass, then it's kind of an accident that this actually even works. So it could have been that if this stuff is there, it could have been that you just don't get a good fit at all, and this motivates putting in more stuff. But okay, I mean, this doesn't prove anything, but it is interesting that it works as is. Off the shelf.
Do you happen to know? I don't actually know what that's the change in the chi square. Do you know what the minimal chi square is for the fit for like 96 then? I don't actually know that.
It's not super great, but it's like it's quote unquote maybe like a little bit over one sigma away from optimal.
Okay, well, we can look it up later.
I think I've seen it quoted like the probability of having the standard model is like 30% as far as the best fit value goes. Mm-hmm. Something along those lines. Do you know this before?
No.
So I mean, there are a few deviations. Like there's a four Lacrae symmetry, the B quark. There's an atom. Actually, there's a story related to that blue band plot. But I don't want to get into that. Okay, in any case, if I move this coupling with the Higgs and I integrate it out, I generate this correction with the Higgs out. For the Higgs mass. And if this new physics is heavy and this coupling's not tiny,
this correction is really, really big. So this could very easily destabilize the Higgs mass. One way to fix this, and I have a bit of a bias, but it's my favorite, is supersymmetry. And supersymmetry, for each heavy particle, it comes into the superpartner. These bad corrections cancel, and you get, I shouldn't have put zero, it's small, plus corrections from Susie breaking. Of course, phenomenologically, supersymmetry has to be broken. But as long as this breaking is soft, where the soft scale is less than about a TeV, you still get an effective protection of the Higgs potential that's numerically good enough to stabilize the electroweak scale. But you run into other problems when you add just about any kind of new physics. I guess, Michael, you've been thinking a lot about this. And one thing that comes up in supersymmetry is there are lots of new sources of flavor violation. So for example, in supersymmetry, you can have the scalar Lestrange quark mixed with the scalar down quark through this soft mass coupling. And generically, there's no reason for this to be small. And phenomenologically, it does have to be small. So for example, you can have kaon mixing going through these mass insertions, going through this mass mixing, where you you flip your strange and you're down. And phenomenologically, the ratio of this off-diagonal piece relative to the reciprocal scale of the diagonal piece, assuming it's on the order of about a TeV, has to be less than sort of order 10 to the minus 3. So without any additional structure in your Suzy sector, there's no good reason why this should be true. So this motivates us to look for ways to break supersymmetry in that does, in some sense, respect the flavor structure. So this brings me to gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking. This is one way to, I'll say, mediate the breaking of supersymmetry breaking in a way that is nice in terms of flavor. Okay, as the name suggests, you're just mediating the supersymmetry breaking through gauge interactions. The very minimal model of this consists of you take your supersymmetrized standard model, and you take some hidden sector where supersymmetry breaking happens. I'm going to parameterize the supersymmetry breaking by this X field. And this X field, here I'm just going to treat it being non-dynamical. It gets some zero component VEV and some auxiliary component VEV. And this auxiliary component VEV parameterizes the supersymmetry breaking in this hidden sector. I'm not going to specify the dynamics here. And this field is assumed to have a superpotential coupling to these phis. So these phis, in the minimal implementation, are assumed to have the gauge quantum numbers of a 5.5 bar under SU5. This isn't to say there has to be unification. I'm just saying that these are states with the quantum numbers of an SU5 when you decompose it under 3.2.1. The motivation, or one motivation to put in a 5+5 bar is that, well, first of all, it will mediate to everything, and it also preserves gauge unification. That's something you'd like to do. So in any case, what happens is I have supersymmetry breaking here. These guys carry gauge quantum numbers. And these guys, through gauge interactions, are going to connect to the supersymmetric standard model. So for example, if I look at the scalar soft masses, I generate through gauge mediation soft scalar masses at the two loop level. So you have here's your fermion going along. It talks to a gauge boson. The gauge boson talks to the phis, the mediator field. The mediator field talks to the x's, the supersymmetry breaking. And you put this all together, and there's some other diagrams. You put it all together, and you get this answer. It comes in at two loop order. So you get a g to the fourth over 4 pi to the fourth. This is a loop factor. This is some. This is just a Dinkin index. It's just some group theory factor. And the supersymmetry breaking comes in this factor of F over M. And the nice thing about this, and one of the big motivations to look at gauge mediation, is that the structure is automatically flavor universal. Just because gauge bosons couple universally to all different flavors, and they couple diagonally. So at least at the messenger matching scale, where you compute these diagrams and effectively integrate out the messengers, the soft masses you generate are universal. They're the same for all the generations, and they're diagonal in flavor space. Okay. There are also contributions to the Gaugino soft masses. Here, these come in at one loop, and they go essentially as one loop factor times F over M. I should also add that since this is one loop, and if you go back and look at the scalar masses, these are two loop. If I take the square root of this, the size of these scalar masses are the same as the size of the Gaugino masses, up to order unity factors. On top of that, generically, when I break supersymmetry, I generate a mass with a gravitino, the superpartner of the graviton. And assuming this F term is the only source of supersymmetry breaking around, the gravitino mass I generate is simply the value of F over M Planck. So this messenger scale isn't really fixed, in the sense that the thing that sets the soft masses is a ratio of F over M. And this can float around as long as it gives me the right value for the physical soft masses I want. So in other words, I want my F over M to be about a loop factor bigger than the soft masses I want. For the gravitino mass, this is always M Planck. This is fixed. So the upshot is that the gravitino is much, much lighter than all of my superpartners, provided the messenger mass scale is much, much less than the loop factor times the point mass. So typically, in models of gauge mediation, where you have a somewhat lower messenger scale, you get a very light gravitino that's very often your lightest superparticle.
It doesn't have to be. I mean, well, it can cause problems, but it can cause problems. These problems depend on the cosmological history. For example, they typically depend on your reading temperature. Mm-hmm. And they're different for different reading temperatures and gravitino masses because you run into different problems. You can run into problems with dark matter abundances. You can run into problems with late decays of your standard model, your lightest standard model partner, into the gravitino that messes up BVM and all kinds of stuff.
I thought it was great at BVM.
It doesn't have to. So I'm going to look at the case where the decays happen very quickly. So I'm going to look at a very light gravitino. I'll come to this in a little bit. And for a very light gravitino, this state has a small relative abundance, and the decays happen well before BVM, and it's safe.
So it has a small relative abundance because it's thermalized, or?
Oh no, it's not thermalized. It's just very, very light. So I've actually in this case.
Because usually, if you make a gravitino very light, then you easily overshoot the relative charge, right? Sensitive to the reading temperature.
Oh yeah, so I.
But if you make it very light, then.
I'm not trying to make up the relative abundance with the gravitino. I'm assuming the relative abundance is coming from somewhere else. But as long as the relative abundance comes from somewhere else, and there are lots of ways this can happen. So for example, there are models of gate mediation where you have extra stuff in the messenger sector that happens to be stable that fixes things up. And there are other possibilities, but. As far as I'm concerned here, I just want to make sure that it's not ruled out by cosmology. And in this light gravitational mass range, it's not ruled out. You do need another source of dark matter, but...
this doesn't impose a constraint on the messenger mass scale. It's just, you're saying it just imposes constraints on the decay patterns and lifetime of the gravitino, which is not...
Yeah, but also on the cosmological history.
Yeah. Okay.
But actually, in this case, with a very light gravitino, if your gravity is light enough, these bounds essentially all go away, as long as you have some other source of dark. OK, so the thing I showed you is a very minimal, the most minimal gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking scenario you can write down. And not surprisingly, in this minimal scenario, you get very specific predictions. So for example, the lightest superpartners of the standard model states happen to be the Beano and the right-handed sleptons. So the Beano and the right-handed sleptons only get contributions from the hypercharged gauge coupling. Remember that the soft masses are proportional to gauge couplings that they're charged under. And these states happen to be light simply because of the hierarchy of the hypercharged gauge coupling is smaller than the SC2 gauge coupling, smaller than the SC3 gauge coupling. So the upshot is that your lightest standard model superpartners are a Beano and light sleptons. So we know from Lux searches that unless you play some funny games, the light slepton, the masses of the right-handed sleptons have to be heavier than about 100 GeV, just from searches for charged particles. And in these minimal models of GMSB, these right-handed sleptons have roughly the same mass as the light Beano mass, the lightest neutralino, which happens to be mostly Beano. And in fact, these right-handed sleptons can actually be lighter than the light Beano. On the other hand, the Higgs, generically in minimal supersymmetric standard models, has to be lighter than about 130 GeV, provided your soft masses aren't too big. So the upshot of this is that in minimal gauge mediation, it's just not phenomenologically allowed to have the Higgs decay into neutralinos. The neutralino is forced to be too heavy for the Higgs to get into. I should add, though, that you can have heavier Higgses that do decay into these states that also go to photon gravitino, and this possibility has been considered by Diaz Cruz and company a while back.
So what is the phenomenology of the usual Higgs, the same as in the standard model?
So in minimal gauge mediation, as long as you're in the so-called decoupling element of the MSSM, the Higgs is almost identical to the standard model Higgs in terms of its decays and such. Okay, but of course, this is only the minimal case. You can do much, much fancier things in terms of gauge mutation, and this might be able to open up space into more interesting case to case. So, one possibility, this goes under the name of general gauge mediation. This is due to Beat, Seiberg, and Shi. I should add that even though it's called general gauge mediation, it's not necessarily the most general thing you can write down that falls into what someone might call gauge mediation. They make essentially two assumptions, but within these two assumptions, they're general. And these two assumptions are that the soft masses you generate through the supersymmetry breaking mechanism go to zero as you turn off the standard model gauge couplings. And the second assumption is the standard model gauge couplings remain weakly coupled, so you can expand them. And the technique that comes out of this, the technique that they introduced, can be understood in terms of laws. You can write down the unknown gauge mediation dynamics just by parameterizing them in terms of laws and using symmetries and supersymmetry to constrain the form of these blob couplings. And this gives you a very general parameterization of the possibilities subject to these assumptions. So this is essentially the blob analysis. What I showed you before for the Gaugino mass, here instead of having a loop with stuff sticking out, here I just have some blob. In general, I don't know what's going on inside the blob, but I can parameterize it. And the symmetries tell me that the Gaugino soft mass I get is proportional to the gauge coupling times some blob function, what I'll call BA. Similarly, I can do the same thing for scalar masses. And these also have blobs. And I have similar diagrams connecting into them. But again, I don't know what's going on inside the blob. But the structure of the couplings and supersymmetry and the symmetries force my soft masses to be essentially some loop factors times another set of blob functions. So just to compare, let me flip back. For the Gaugino masses, this is what we had in the minimal gauge mediation case. And the difference with the minimal gauge mediation case is that we knew what was going on in this loop. We could calculate this loop. Everything was perturbative. And we can say what this answer is explicitly. And similarly for the soft masses. On the other hand, in general gauge mediation, I just replace these by blobs. You can see that they have the same form as the minimal case. But the difference is now I have six independent blob functions. I have three independent blob functions for the scalars and three independent blob functions for the Gauginos. And in particular, all these blob functions are mutually independent in principle. And the upshot of that is I have a six parameter set of possibilities for gauge mediation. And it turns out that people have gone off and they've constructed models that span this six parameter family, this six parameter set. So the upshot of this, well, let me also say that even though this is called general gauge mediation, there's stuff that people call gauge mediation that's more general than this that violate their assumptions. So for example, very often you might have extra couplings to supersymmetry breaking in the Higgs sector to generate the mu term. You might have singlets that couple to the messengers that couple to the Higgses and do stuff there. You might have extra hypercharged D terms. These things have additional couplings that can induce supersymmetry breaking as you take the gauge couplings to zero. But they still fall into sort of a broader class of extra general gauge mediation. But in any case, the point I want to make, and the upshot of all this general gauge mediation hoo-ha, is that in principle, the Beano mass and the right-handed Slepton mass in these generalized models of gauge mediation are independent in principle. So if I allow myself to consider general models, I can move them around independently of each other. And once I liberate the Beano mass from the Luck constraints on the right-handed Slepton mass, I can now make it light enough for the Higgs, the standard model-like Higgs, to get to decay into. So at this point, if this decay channel opens up, the phenomenology depends on my scale of supersymmetry breaking. So in the case of high-scale gauge mediation, the decays of the Beano to a gravitino and a photon
turn out to be very they turn out to take a long, long time. And they end up being long enough that the Beanos are stable on collider scales, and therefore the Higgs signature from this decay mode is that of an invisible Higgs. The Higgs just decays into nothing, and you don't see anything other than perhaps missing energy. It turns out that you can actually do LUP searches for this, and there are Tevatron. You can do LUP searches, you can do LHC searches, and you can do pretty well for this. This has been studied by Ively and Zeppenfeld and others. But the phenomenology of this mode is pretty well known. What we concentrated on instead is the case of low-scale gauge mediation in these generalized models, where we have a prompt decay of the neutralino into gravitino photon. And we looked at these new signatures. We were actually a bit surprised this hadn't been done before, because it's not so crazy, but I think previously there had been a very strong bias towards minimal gauge mediated models, where this doesn't actually happen. And that's the only reason we can see why it hadn't been looked at.
We've been living in Europe and we're so sold on it. Could you have your whole channel be known to be as important in a gravitated model? Or?
If you want to open this up, you need to push down your supersymmetry breaking scale. So that already expelled me from Europe.
All right. The thing about gravity is that it's a generic feature that you can get beyond everything. It doesn't mean that you're better than the gravity, right?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, another possibility is something gravity mediated, or let's say anomaly mediated.
Yeah.
And or anomaly mediation with something to fix up the tachyons, or let's say supergravity with flavor structures. I mean, those are other possibilities.
So the important thing for you is what?
Well, the thing that changes the phenomenology is that we have I'll come to this a bit later, but for this to be prompt,
yeah,
on collider scales,
like a muscle, right?
you need to have a variable gravity on this. Because otherwise the neutrinos are long-lived on collider scales, they just shoot. So you really have to push down the gravitational mass. You really have to push down the gravitational mass in to get this to happen promptly, to get the signature.
So as long as you, whatever you do, you end up getting a prompt in the photon, then you're getting a plot.
Yeah. So for example, you could probably cook up other models where you have coupling, let's say some higher dimensional operator, coupling a photon, some kind of magnetic movement operators, like coupling your LSP to some light state in the photon. But this is something that already happens. And the phenomenology in that case should be pretty similar to this, after the structure of the precise vertex.
What can you say about the new problem here?
Sorry?
The new problem for the...
We don't actually say anything about that. So that is a problem in these models, and there are proposals to fix it up. We didn't address that. So the thing you expect in the new problem is that when you fix it up, you typically have to couple the Higgs somehow to supersymmetry breaking, or maybe put in a singlet. If you're coupling the Higgs to supersymmetry breaking, this can end up modifying your soft terms of the third generation relative to the first two. But the first two generation soft terms don't tend to do too much. And third generation stuff could shift around, but for the most part, this won't actually change this phenomenology too much. The thing we're relying on is really that we're able to push the Beano to be a fair bit lighter than the scalars. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, fixing up the new problem is fairly orthogonal to what we're looking at. And we didn't try to address that because that's a whole series of papers on itself.
Right, but it's almost reachable. That's the biggest problem for getting ideas.
Yes.
But to work on the usage of dimension.
We just
emphasize the flavor.
Yes, but for example, even if you have extra supersymmetry breaking, somehow coupling of the Higgses, and it comes almost to the third generation, this is still pretty much okay in terms of flavor. Or at least it's much, much safer than the first two generations.
You can see I come from Europe.
So the flavor point here is just that you get basically an approximate Moule pair violation, which only gets broken by loop running, right?
Yes.
So does that set an upper bound on how high the scale could be?
No, I think it's generically safe. I mean, essentially, it's a pretty good approximation. It's just the talking power running. that's pushing around some of the soft assets.
So it can be an arbitrarily high scale. The log running doesn't get you into trouble with effective.
Not that I know of. I haven't seen any very explicit analyses of flavor in this, but I think it's generically fine because it's all essentially the top. I mean, in the case of the bottom, you have this will mix things up a little bit, but it's a small number. So you might be looking at some enhancements for large time data. We're actually going to be in a small time data region, so we'll be in a small time data region. We'll also be at a very low scale, so flavor should not be an issue at all. Anyway, we want to have our Higgs decaying into a fairly light neutralino. And you might worry, for example, that this neutralino is bounded strongly by LEP searches and other searches. So for example, at LEP, this is obviously an E plus E minus collider, the main production modes at LEP are through gauge boson, just to draw the N, as well as S-channel slepton exchange. In this case,
sources of CP violation if you have a low scale for this for all the supersymmetric partners, you're gonna have these extra phases and then you do better
than you would otherwise in the sense that your A terms are essentially zero engaged mediation. I didn't show this, but your A terms get generated at a higher loop. So your CP violation is going to come from essentially a relative phase between you and the gauging of masses, at least at the renormalizable level. You'll have that phase and you'll have the BMU phase. And that stuff couples into how you
fix up the new problem, which we haven't addressed. So yes, there are potential CP violation problems in these models, which again, we didn't address here.
I just would like to know what the range of scales where the symmetry breaking can go on, where soft mass terms can come in. What's the lower mass phenomenological? What's the higher mass? But are you saying that just the models? There's just so many options in the model building that basically
you can't say
anything specific about that.
In this case, questions like that, let's say from higher dimensional operators suppressed by the Messenger scale, yeah, are going to depend on the CP violating situation in your messenger sector and the supersymmetry breaking sector. And we're treating that as a black box. But in principle, it can't be a problem. And actually, in fact, in these models, these CP problems can potentially be worse than in minimal gauge mediation. So in minimal gauge mediation, you have a universal phase for the gauging of masses, because everything is just F over M. And the F term could, for example, have a non-zero phase relative to others. Whereas here, you have these independent functions that parameterize three different gauging of masses. And those could, in principle, have three different phases.
Yeah.
So in that sense, CP violation could be worse. But again, we didn't address that here. But it's something to worry about.
We're also going to have a messenger scale. Once you put in the loop factor, the messenger scale typically has to be larger than about 50 keV anyhow. So this is sort of starting to get to a point where CP violation isn't so bad from those operators. Well, at least from the higher dimensional operators. You still have to worry about them in the renormalizable softness. Okay, in any case, at LEP, your two main production modes are here and here. There have been searches for gauge mediation at LEP that essentially look for E plus E minus to two photons plus missing ET. If you allow this to go up to high root S, the cross section bound you get is about 10 femtobarns. So as long as your cross section is less than about 10 femtobarns, you're okay. For the branching fraction for invisible Z decays, you could, for example, have for a very light neutralino, your Z goes to two neutralinos, the gamma gamma plus missing ET. This branching fraction has to be very, very small, less than roughly 10 to the minus 6. And the upshot of this is that, at least to the extent that we can make our selectron heavy, to satisfy these bounds, we effectively need our neutralino mass, our neutralino, to couple very, very weakly to gauge bosons. So
variation. This the case, what I mean, this how would you see that there will be variation? So you have got correlation, you can get this this event happening.
Oh yeah, so this event happening does not necessarily mean stage mediation.
Right. So.
But gauge mediation is an example where you get this kind of event happening. So it goes one direction, but it doesn't go the other. So for example, there's a paper not too long ago looking at UED, where you have essentially an anomaly in the KK parity symmetry, and your LKP, your lightest KK odd particle, has a through the anomaly decays to photons. So this was constructed as an example that can give an example that's not gauge mediation, that can give signals of missing energy and photons. So just
lots,
because you...
I have to say there's lots of examples of that, because I made some of myself. The idea is you can have there's lots of exponential ways in which you can have these things in the exponentials and the legs. You have them just what's happening on the watch for photons. Anywhere you have to make something.
Sure. So here I'm just trying to construct one specific example that gives us, but you're right. There are other possibilities for it. Okay,
but having said that, when you look at these kind of various ways of getting the basic channel you're looking for, it exposed to photon plus missing energy. Is there a signal that will distinguish these models from the extra dimension models from other things that have that same channel?
I think this starts to put you into this starts to put you into kind of the standard telling this gives you apart from other stuff case where you need to effectively go off the member spins.
One thing people often say is that you can have hard to get versus a lot of soft things because you have a bunch of cascades in your system.
But you can have cascades in, let's say, UED.
Yeah, you don't need it, but any of the models you can just have something hard, and then if you found hard things, then you probably heard the getting this kind of model. I've heard those word set, but I've never seen a flat time before.
Yeah, no, there's a prejudice in UED to put all the KK states pretty close to each other.
I'm not thinking specifically in UED.
But even in UED, you can put in more junk on the boundary to split these states and essentially reproduce SUSY cascades. Or you can get fairly split stuff in, let's say, little Higgs models with T parity.
So all the models you know have all these cascades?
Yeah.
I know models that don't have cascades, and so has anyone quantified to what extent if you see... Because then photon with missing energy, I remember one of the things we found in the old days was that the missing energy gives you really handle the background, because the standard model is not getting a lot of missing energy when it's still out.
Yes.
So your sensitivity to this and the exotic is pretty good.
Yeah, what's the true gauge mediation?
Yeah, right. So that should be generic, but then supposing you see it, I'm just wondering if that's what short of actually seeing spins, are there kind of a fast rules of thumb that you can use to identify classes of models, like hard associated checks or like that? And is that about that?
Not that I know of, but for just about any SUSY signature, if you don't go on measure spins, I can cook up something in, let's say, UED or little Higgs that can do roughly the same thing.
It's a paper on this lone Higgs that I'm interested in. They're looking at the questions you're looking at, and they're answering the right questions.
But are they also just looking at these models that have cascades? Because it's true that you have to cascade models in here. There are models that are not cascades.
Yeah, but very often when you don't have cascades, you'll have some direct reduction. In that case, that tends to push up the scale of your inferences. Makes your life harder.
So if I gave you a model where you wasn't so high, the rates are still detectable, then and wasn't a cascade, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at, let's say, like RS, and you see resonances. And in that case, you don't have cascades. But I mean, that's a very different phenomenology.
You can do the same thing and look at Tevatron bounds on the light state. Here, the dominant production modes are Drellian to two neutralinos. You could also have direct color production, but we're assuming our scalars, our squarks, and gluinos are somewhat heavier, so that just because of the kinematic limits, this is the dominant SUSY production. And from the CDF gauge mediation search, they look at essentially inclusive diphoton plus missing energy signatures. So they don't really care about what's upstream of the two photons in the missing ET. So that's what I call X. And in this inclusive picture, they get bounds that the cross section has to be less than about 20 femtoarcs. And the upshot of this is that again, to be allowed, you need the neutralino coupling to the gauge bosons to be kind of small.
Several years ago, people were claiming that they did not see supersymmetry of the Teletron. Well, what kind of events they were seeing?
Oh, well, I mean, I think over 10 years ago, there were funny...
10 years ago,
well, there are funny extra leptons and photons, and people were trying to write down, gave me a model to pick that up. That went away, so I don't know the precise number of that story, other than it went away. Okay, so...
Well, the upshot is that we want our light neutralino to be very weakly coupling to gauge bosons. And the only possibility here is for our light neutralino to be mostly BINO, because it doesn't couple to gauge bosons, whereas other stuff that could go into the neutralino, like let's say Higgs-enos or WINOs, do couple to gauge bosons. And the upshot of that is our state is going to be mostly, it turns out in this case, we want our state to be mostly BINO. And the BINO Higgs, the BINO tends to mix with the Higgs-eno, but the BINO doesn't mix with the WINO. So our neutralino state is essentially going to be a BINO with a small admixture of Higgs-eno. And if you look at the mixing, this mixing roughly goes like a product of sine beta, cos beta times the Higgs valve over the mu term. And the origin of the Higgs neutralino coupling, now we also want our Higgs to not couple too much, well, we want our Higgs to couple to neutralinos with a fair strength, but we also don't want our gauge bosons to couple too strongly to the neutralinos. So if you look at the Higgs coupling, the origin of the Higgs coupling to the light neutralinos, the relevant operator is this one, where you have a Higgs, its Higgs-eno superpartner, and the BINO. So to couple this to two light neutralinos, essentially this state is one light neutralino, and this state means that you have to do an insertion, a Higgs-eno insertion, to mix this Higgs-eno into the BINO. Whereas, if I look at the coupling of the electroweak gauge bosons to neutralinos, I'd need two Higgs-eno insertions. Just because the Higgs-eno isn't coupling directly to the BINO, the place where I'm getting the coupling is a Higgs-eno coupling is two Higgs-enos coupling to a gauge boson. So there, I need two Higgs-eno insertions. For the Higgs insertion, the Higgs coupling, I only need one insertion. So the upshot of this is that this coupling goes like epsilon squared. This coupling goes like epsilon, and this gives me a chance to make this effective coupling fairly small, while keeping this one not too tiny. And if you recall, the thing I need to fight against to get a decent Higgs branching fraction into neutralinos is Higgs to BV bar. And the Higgs to BV bar coupling is down by the bottom Yukawa. So it's down by a factor of the B mass over the electroweak mass. So about a factor of about 1/100. So what we did at this point is just scan away. Scan over parameter space, general gauge mediation parameter space, and look for parameters that gave us a decent branching fraction of a decent branching fraction for the Higgs, while not violating these various bounds. What we find, well, if we only apply let bounds, we get this green region. This green region is great. This green region shoots up almost to about 0.5. You can also see the green region is cutting off very sharply at about 45 GeV. That comes from the invisible Z decay bound. Turns out to be fairly strict. On the other hand, if we impose the Tevatron bounds, the Tevatron bounds actually end up being a bit stricter. The Tevatron bounds force us to live down here. So when you figure in the Tevatron bounds, you can only push up the branching fraction to about 0.15, but this is still not too bad. And to maximize it, you want fairly small tan beta and fairly small mu. The smaller the value of tan beta and the smaller the value of mu, the more Higgs-eno mixing you get. And this pushes up the Higgs coupling. You can also see from this plot, where we plot the allowed region as a function of the mu term and tan beta, that effectively the Tevatron bound cuts you off very sharply for a value of mu about 250 GeV. And the reason for that is essentially just kinematics of the Tevatron. The dominant Tevatron production mode for total Chargino neutralino comes mostly from when the tevatron is producing two Higgsino states directly, instead of these light states. And for values of mu above 250 GeV, these states are just heavy enough that the cross section is small enough to get around the tevatron bounds. So the tevatron is kind of spoiling our fun a bit, but a branch fraction of 0.5 is still not too bad.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So the red region is the stuff that's consistent with everything.
And that's where, but in the bottom, I'm just wondering how much does the branching change when you go over that red region?
It's
0.15 when in the sort of the bottom corner.
Yeah. So this is effectively the branching fraction of the value of the mass. And if I didn't have to worry about the tevatron bound, I could get to almost 0.5. I should also add that because my branching fraction to neutralinos is only 0.15, and the rest of the decay modes are basically standard model like, I don't really change any of the left bounds on the neutralinos. So I'm still stuck with those 114, up to very small changes.
So you're actually bounding for exercise with mu, right? Because you said you want to be in the decoupling limit, and that means that you need
mu. Mu doesn't have to be too large for decoupling. I mean, for decoupling, it's more the NA you have to push up. The pseudo-scalar case. So maybe I'm using decoupling in a different sense than you're thinking of. By decoupling, I just mean that the pseudo-scalar states, the heavy Higgs states, are pretty heavy. And when you push those masses up, the light state is basically the standard model Higgs boson plus corrections that go like mz squared over ma squared. That's what I mean specifically by decoupling.
So making mu very heavy, does it imply that MA gets very heavy?
Well, the B mu term comes in, which is formally independent from mu. Okay, so we want to look at neutralino decays to photons and gravitinos. Please have to hurry up. So the gravitino is a mixture of superpartner of the graviton, as well as the Goldsteino, a massless fermion corresponding to supersymmetry breaking. And effectively, we only have to worry about the spin 1/2 components of the full gravitino in this case. So there's something called the Goldsteino equivalence theorem. I think it's due to Faye. It's essentially a generalization of the Goldsteino equivalence theorem. And roughly, it says that the Goldsteino, the spin 1/2 Goldsteino components of the gravitino couples 1 over f, where f is a scale of supersymmetry breaking, whereas, as you expect, the transverse supergravity components of the gravitino couple like 1 over m Planck squared. So for us, we're looking at a fairly low scale of gauge mediation, so our value of f isn't so big. So this Goldsteino coupling is much, much bigger than the genuine gravity coupling. And in this limit, the effect of Goldsteino coupling, this g tilde is our Goldsteino, this derivative corresponds to the equivalence theorem, is, again, the coupling is 1 over f times some higher dimensional operator. And the structure of this coupling is that you take the Goldsteino, you couple it to a standard model field, and the standard model field is a superpartner. And then there's some other terms with scalars and fermions. So the upshot of this is you can compute the decay length, and it goes roughly like it's proportional to the square of the gravitino mass. And if we look at the scale of gauge mediation, we assumed that the scale of gauge mediation was roughly as low as you can get away with, while still getting a reasonable mass target. So this corresponds to a gravitational mass of 0.6 eV, corresponding to an F term of about 50 TeV. Here are our scan points as a function of the C tau. The boosts in this case from the Higgs are going to be order 1, so we didn't include those. But you can see that this scale is in centimeters as a function of the mass. This fall off just corresponds to the mx to the fifth dependence. And you can see that generically, in this interesting region, our c tau is it's always less than a centimeter. Now, a centimeter is macroscopic, but the thing that's coming out of these states, and at the end of the day, are going to be two photons. And if you look at what detectors can do in terms of figuring out where photons are coming from, or for example at D0, they can use their electromagnetic colorimeter to reconstruct the track of a photon within it. So maybe I'll draw a quick picture. So if I look straight down the beam pipe at a collider, I have the beam, I have some tracking region in here, where in this tracking region, I get tracks of charged particles. And then my next layer is an electromagnetic calorimeter. Call it eCal. And then around this, I have my hadronic calorimeter, hCal. And then around this, I have a muon, my muon chamber, the text muons. So the signal of a photon is, you don't see the photon in the tracking chamber. So you don't see it here, but it deposits its energy in the eCal. And it basically stops cooling the eCal before the hCal. And what D0 can do, and what some of the other experiments can do, is they get effectively a track in the eCal, which just corresponds to some hits in their calorimeter lighting up. And they can use this to point the direction back toward the beam light. And essentially point the photon back to see where it's coming from. And it turns out that because of their grading and because of the structure, they can do this to about 2 centimeters. So put another way, these photons are effectively prompt as far as D0 is concerned. And this stuff goes through basically the same for Atlas, for example. Actually, there's one trick at Atlas, but I'm not sure I have time for that.
OK, so for the Tevatron Higgs searches, one of the standard Higgs search modes at the Tevatron, at the LHC, I guess also the Tevatron, is Higgs decays to 2 photons. This only has a small branching fraction, but it's pretty clean in terms of background. And in the standard model, the branching fraction is about 10^-3. The Tevatrons also look for it. And the Tevatron can bound the branching fraction times the cross section to be about 15 times, to be less than about 15 times larger than what you expect in the standard model. On the other hand, we have a branching fraction to 2 photons, also with missing energy of about 0.15. This is obviously much, much bigger than 10^-3. So maybe this signal could be observable at the Tevatron and so on. To do this, we took a sample point with judiciously chosen parameters consistent with general gauge mediation. And we did a collider study of this. First of all, let me say that this point is consistent with LUP and Tevatron bounds that currently exist. The branching fraction of the Higgs to two neutralinos is about 0.1. The Higgs mass is just over 114, and the neutralino mass is about 47 GeV. Okay, so for the Tevatron, we started off by looking at the inclusive diphoton search at D0. And in this inclusive search, you require 2 photons with PT greater than 25 GeV, and they're fairly central. And what we find, simulating the same thing in our setup for the Higgs decays, is our signal corresponds to this black line. So this peak here is the usual standard model Higgs to 2 photons. It's a very narrow resonance, so you're stuck in here. But we also have this. We also have a second decay through the neutralinos, giving us 2 photons, and our neutralino decay gives us this smeared out bump. So on the one hand, we get way more events because the branching fraction is larger. The downside, though, is that these have a lower diphoton invariant mass, and they're also smeared out over many bins, as opposed to the nice single bin you have for the standard model diphoton decay. Let me also add that there's a kinematic endpoint here. This kinematic endpoint depends on the Higgs mass and the neutralino mass. And one thing that would be nice, that's nice about this channel, is that suppose you find the Higgs in this diphoton mode, this would give you the Higgs mass. If you can also measure this shoulder, this would give you a nice absolute measurement of the neutralino mass, something that's often very difficult to get in SUSY scenarios. Now, unfortunately, the background from the standard model is up here. So we just get swamped by background. It's also a little bit worse because this peak gets smeared out. So it's not even in one bin. So your signal to background is just awful. So the Tevatron isn't so great in this inclusive search. What you can do, though, is add a cut of missing energy. So G0, for example, does a similar search for two photons, but they also had to cut a missing energy to look for gauge-mediated bonds. And it turns out that in this case, if you add a cut a missing energy of about 30 GeV, you get rid of the background falls down a whole lot. So if I go back, this is my signal when I impose a cut of missing energy greater than 30 GeV. And my background, well, I didn't draw the background, but my background just falls right off the mat. No, not quite right off the mat. But my background now becomes sort of about the same order as my signal. The only problem is the signal rate's not so big. But for example, I can get roughly signal over background of about 3 with 10 inverse central bonds, which isn't great. But it's not great, but this is, I should add, better than the standard model searches for a Higgs mass less than 125 GeV at the Tevatron through standard BV, through the standard modes they use. So this still isn't great, but it's not too bad. One thing that we've been talking with the collaborations, the experimental collaborations about, is doing a better search using smarter cuts. So this is a plot. This is a heat plot of the number of events as a function of the diphoton invariant mass versus the missing energy in the event. And so most of the events are concentrated around here. What the thing that D0 is doing is they just cut a missing energy greater than 30 GeV. So they take the 30 GeV and they cut straight across here. So you're cutting out a whole lot of the signal. So you can imagine that instead using a smarter cut in this plane, so for example, using a cut that goes something like kind of curves down a bit, might give you a much larger acceptance for the signal, and you could actually do a lot better than this significance of about 3 at the Tevatron. So we're bugging the collaborations about this. At the LHC, this Higgs to two photons is the best search mode for a fairly light Higgs. Studies that have been done show that you need about 15 inverse Fermat barns of data to find the Higgs in this mode, just to get enough events to be down the background. In this case, again, we have more events because we have a larger branching fraction. But they're also smeared out. They're not all in one bin. They're smeared out over many bins. So we did a similar study to what we did for the Tevatron using our same sample point, which again has a branching fraction of about 0.1 and fairly reasonable masses. Okay, so first of all, we looked at inclusive diphotons at ATLAS, where we don't require any cuts other than two photons in the event that are fairly hard. So the existing diphoton search at ATLAS uses PT cuts of 40 and 25 GeV and some centrality cut and then various isolation cuts. And what we find is our signal from the Higgs, but we have our standard model Higgs signal. In practice, this gets smeared up by the detector, so it's not quite as good as this. But without smearing, this is what it looks like. This is the standard model Higgs decayed diphotons. And this is our smeared neutralino mode. This is the SUSY events from, this is the total SUSY production. So the total SUSY production is in some sense a background to this Higgs search. If you only require two photons and you don't use any missing ET cuts. But the SUSY signal is also still fairly subleading to the actual Higgs signal. Now, it turns out that if we apply a cut on the diphoton invariant mass of about 60 to 90 GeV, so if we sum over this region, and we just do a counting experiment of the signal versus background, which is up here, we get a pretty good signal over root background. We get about 1 for inverse femtobarn. So it turns out that at least based on statistics alone, you can do a discovery with about 20 inverse femtobarns. The downside of this, though, is we did include systematics. And systematics are likely to be a big pain in the neck here because, well, this background has various uncertainties about how high or how low it is, from luminosity, from things like jets taking photons. So the fact that there's not much of a shape here means that, in fact, the systematics are probably going to kill this off. But to really say whether it will, you need to do sort of a more careful detector analysis. So we're generating the curves. So we generate the distributions in HIPIA, and we scale all the cross sections to match up with real calculations in the cross section. So essentially, we're taking the relative distributions from HIPIA, and we're scaling everything to get the cross section rate.
So the proper answer is
you're just taking the shape that you're getting. You're just multiplying by
rescaling factor. Yes.
And how do you know that rescaling factor? Sorry, I missed that.
You take the Pythia cross section. You compare it to the n to whatever LO cross section, and you scale it.
You mean for the standard model signal?
Oh no, but it's just a total cross section. I mean, the fact that you have more decay modes doesn't change the cross section. It's just a production cross section, and you scale that.
You mean for the standard model background?
Oh no, sorry. We didn't simulate this standard model background ourselves. So the standard model background, yeah, this is one thing we didn't do. The standard model background is a huge headache.
Yes.
Because it depends on things like it's very detector dependent. So
I mean, I'm just thinking of the plots that are in their TDRs, and it's not just one curve. It's like this combination of
different things.
The digest fakes you mentioned.
Well, exactly.
The Grelian, all like tons of stuff.
Exactly.
And the uncertainty bands are big.
Yeah. Well, that's
a straight line.
That's exactly what I'm saying. The systematics are big. We didn't try to simulate the background. This background curve is lifted from the TDR.
Yeah. So.
So in any case, we have a better move. So let me go again.
Okay.
So the better way to do it is to demand other stuff in the event. So one example of this is associated WZ Higgs production. So this is much cleaner because you have extra leptons from the gauge boson decay. So there's a CMS search for this, where they require at least one lepton, and photon PT is greater than 30 and 25 GeV in some data cut. And this happens to be pretty clean. After applying various cuts and rescaling by efficiencies and so on, we get a signal over root background of about 1.3. So this isn't that much better from the inclusive search. But the thing is, the systematics are under much better control. You have these leptons, the standard model backgrounds are much better understood. And the fact that you just have a lot more events here than in the standard model makes this a pretty good discovery mode. So here we estimate about 16 inverse central bonds are what you need for discovery.
One way to translate what I just said before, and again with this mode, is what is the error on what you're quoting for the signal with the background? Do you have any estimate of that?
So,
I mean, I think the qualitative point is fine, but
how much
do I trust that this is better and that it's 1.2 as opposed to 1? I mean.
Okay. So the background uncertainty is maybe plus or minus 5, or so, at least based on the TDRs. And I can't do better than that.
Okay.
The background is very detector dependent. I don't feel qualified to say how often a jet fakes a photon for a given PT.
It's an extremely hard question. I've looked at that.
Exactly.
A very, very hard question.
So, this is the best I feel I can do as a theorist. Okay, so let me wrap up. I'm going to move it over. Let me wrap up with a bit of philosophy. This takes the K-mode. It's not necessarily generic, but it's not so crazy.
And if it's there, it can give us a nice absolute measurement of the neutrino mass. What we did to look at how well one could do is we looked at planned existing D0 search modes and planned existing CMS and Atlas modes. So as it is, there aren't any specific searches for this, but using other searches already planned, you can get at it. However, this was essentially pure dumb luck. So, for example, the D0 gauge mediation search is sensitive to this mode. On the other hand, if you look at the CDF gauge mediation search, they apply a cut on something called HT, which is essentially the sum of PTs in the event plus the massing energy greater than 200 GeV. So, if you're looking for genuine gauge mediation SUSY production, this is just fine, because you tend to have extra jets and leptons and all kinds of junk in your event. And most of your events engage mediation passes. For these Higgs decays, we don't have other stuff in the event. And because we don't have other stuff in the event, applying this cut basically kills off all the signal. So we extrapolated from the D0 search, because they didn't use this cut, whereas the CDF search, which is based on more data and uses this cut, kills off the signal. So this is a case where the set of cuts used might cut out a new physics signal, even if it's there. And I should also add that this cut is perfectly reasonable if you really are looking for gauge mediation. Similarly, if you look at the CMS non-inclusive Higgs to diphoton searches, they apply PT cuts on a leading photon of about 50 GeV. And for us, because our Higgs is only about 115, very, very few of the events have photons with PT greater than 50 GeV. So imposing this cut, the CMS does, on the non-inclusive Higgs to diphoton searches, also kills off most of the signal. So the philosophy I want to emphasize is that we should think about what cuts we're imposing. And maybe consider loosening them in certain cases, or not optimizing them too much for certain models to make sure we don't lose any particular signals. Okay, I'll summarize.
You were only taking that because that was the minimum price for the standard model, right? You could have had that higher in the model.
Oh yeah. So we studied a specific sample point. To get a big Gratzky fraction, you tend to want a smaller value of tan beta, and this tends to make the Higgs lighter.
It tends to be light anyway.
So there's that for one. The second thing is that our A term for the top. Because this is gauge mediation, because our gauge mediation scale is small, this term tends to be very small too. So you don't have much left-right mixing. So because of those two things, you actually tend to come down pretty hard against the Higgs mass. But for example, I'll wrap it up. But for example, one thing we're thinking about is if you just go to, let's say, like an NMSSF where you have a singlet, two fifths of the mu term, this might allow a larger branching fraction because you have an extra F term contribution to the Higgs mass, so let's say push down to engine beta. And then we have some other funny NMSSM modes, low scale gauge mediation. I'll wrap up here. But I guess the moral of the story is there could be all kinds of stuff out there, we don't want to miss anything.
Any questions?
I totally agree with that point. Where are the cuts applied for these photons, these triggers? What level are these cuts involved?
Are
these software, hardware? Where are they actually doing this?
The software level. So
they're a higher level trigger. So they can adjust these dynamics.
They can adjust. Yeah.
Time goes on.
So in fact, these diphoton searches, they basically always trigger on a single photon, and then keep that one photon set. And then they go off and apply their PT cut and so on, and multiple photon requirements offline. So in principle, if you store the data, and you want to go back and look at it, it should be there.
Not like that, as they run, they can dynamically adjust.
Yes. So I've been bugging some people on Atlas and some people on G0 to look into this kind of thing.
Does any aspect of these signatures have a low-level cut that cannot be adjusted? Some of the cuts are hardware.
Some of the cuts are hardware, but no.
I don't think any of these are related for sure.
No. I mean, you're saying essentially trigger level versus analysis cuts.
Yeah.
So at the trigger level, they're pretty broad. So yes, from that point of view, we're safe.
Any other questions? Let's thank David again.